to A Life in Biography. This podcast is number four, part four of a discussion that we've been having, Tim Christian and Carol Sklenica and myself, Carl Rollison. I think this is the fourth and final part, but you never know because Tim has a lot of questions. So we're gonna turn it over to Tim and see what happens.
Well, thank you very much, Carl. It's good to be here with you and Carol. Last podcast.
Whether the author ought to enter the narrative. And I think all of us have done that, but under what circumstances is that permissible?
And to what degree should it take place? And Carl, I believe that you wanted to say more on this topic. So why don't we start off with you?
Sure. Okay. I was thinking when we were talking about it, when do we establish a voice and how do we establish it? And I think it does depend on the kind of biography you're writing. And it suddenly occurred to me while we were talking, there wasn't time then to do it, but I was thinking of my first biography of Martha Gellhorn, which was written while she was alive. And it was a difficult book to do because she wasn't cooperative. And in fact, more than that, was really hostile. At one point, her lawyers sent my publisher a letter trying to get us to drop the book, but we persisted. And I thought about this in terms of, do I just ignore this? That is, in a sense, the background of the biography, how it gets written, or do I somehow write it into the book? And so what I decided to do was write a prologue of a kind that I've not done since, except for Last Days of Sylvia Plath, where I again talk in my own voice about my own experience of going to England in 1963, shortly after Plath died. But I did this in the Gellhorn biography, and I'm just going to read a little part of it to give readers a flavor, and then I want to say something a little bit about how the book was reviewed. It starts with a date, August 8th, 1989. It was getting on towards sunset, the sky turning into darker hues of blue, merging into vivid pockets of light, the green countryside subsiding into shadows. I was beginning to doubt that I would be able to take the photograph of Cat's Cradle that appears in this book. I had never been to Wales and had only the vaguest address to go by. Ron and Beryl Gadd, who have lived in Wales all of their lives, were driving my wife and me through Chepstow, where we hoped to find Martha Gellhorn's cottage. In Chepstow, Ron pulled over to the side of the road and Beryl began asking people whether they had heard of Cat's Cradle, which is supposed to be in New Church West. No one recognized it, but Beryl persisted, on one occasion getting out of the car to ask for directions at a home with a fiercely barking dog. I watched her from the comfort of my back seat, deciding not to test the dog's intentions. After some confused consultation of the map at the Gwent Constabulary and a discussion with a friendly constable, we set off on the road to Shire Newton, which we assumed would take us to New Church West. On the way, certain that we had gone too far, we stopped at a pub. This time, thinking it was safe, I got out, curious to see the interior. No one had heard of Cat's Cradle, but we were on the road to New Church West all right, and they did have places with names such as Cat's Cradle, the Rampant Cat, and such. Another stop, we approached a home with what sounded like a very large dog barking loudly behind a door. I stood behind Beryl as she knocked. After several seconds, a friendly woman appeared, and I finally found my tongue. Does Martha Gellhorn live around here? Her reply startled me, for I had not expected her first words to so exactly recall the way people react when they recognize the name. She said, "The wife of the famous writer?" I'm going to stop there. Famous writer, of course, being Ernest Hemingway. She was his third wife. I hope to inject a little humor into the book about the timid biographer who stands behind other people to try to get the material, and also to show, you know, my utter ignorance in going about this task, undaunted with the help of others. And I thought it was a kind of parable, and it was a way, I hoped, because I expected some hostile reviews, because I was dealing with a living figure who had, as I say, been hostile herself. And I thought, well, this might be a way of approaching the subject and getting people on my side. Well, you know what? No reviewer ever mentioned this prologue. Nobody. Nobody gave me any credit at all for writing such a... My idea of, my clever idea of a kind of defense of myself and showing I was just a regular guy like everybody else didn't work.
And what lesson do you draw from that, Carl?
For some reason, I should have quit, I guess, while I was ahead, but I didn't. I wrote the book. I don't seem to learn these lessons. If the lesson is to the biographer to go away, I can't seem to do that. I ended the book with an epilogue in which I talked about my futile efforts to contact her third husband, T.S. Matthews. And he actually did send me a letter. He replied, but it was a line from Macbeth. Hence, horrible shadow, hence, was his response to me. So I was trying to build in the idea that the biographer is often treated as a villain. But as I say, no one mentioned either the prologue or the epilogue in reviews.
It's interesting. I wonder how much we should take from what reviewers pick up. Or is it, I mean, I personally love that that vignette. I think it really adds to the story because we learn about your voyage of discovery.
Yes.
But
yeah, I also in my acknowledgments, I thanked a number of people, including a general, James Gavin. The funny thing about it was, I mean, it wasn't actually an interview ever because I had picked the wrong James Gavin. It was a British general who also had the Gavin.
That's interesting.
So I had that in the book, too.
That's odd because Gavin was a pretty hot guy, I gather, as far as Martha was concerned.
Yeah. Yeah, and I learned a lot about him. You wouldn't talk to me. The American general, that is, wouldn't talk to me. But I was able to piece together quite a bit of the story itself.
And how about you, Carol? Do you have any reflections on using the biographer's voice? I think the last time we talked about Ellis Adams and your appearance in the epilogue.
Yeah, we did talk about that. And I can tell you a little more that initially some of that material was a prologue and my editor was quite opposed to having my voice at the beginning of the book. And I ended up writing a whole different kind of opening, which I did like better. So I think sometimes writing about yourself, perhaps especially for someone who's new to biography, can be a very helpful way into it. Perhaps you can teach yourself things by using that, and then you may decide to take it out again. You know, if you don't write your first, you know, if it's in your first draft, it may not end up being in your book, but it can really help you just figure out where you're going with a book. I'm much more comfortable with including myself or seeing other biographies that include the author's voice now than I used to be. And I'm thinking about why that is. I think when I wrote my biography of Raymond Carver, because of the opposition I had, I thought that I needed to efface myself as much as possible. I'm interesting to contrast that with Carl's approach to Martha Gellhorn problem. I guess I just thought, do the most thorough and fair job that I could, and that somehow that would succeed, and actually it did. But right now I'm reading a biography in manuscript that's a very difficult story with a lot of black holes in it, and just a lot of problems about knowing what's true and what isn't. And the biographer includes themselves quite a bit, and I think it enhances this particular story. So, you know, I think it depends on the author and it depends on the subject. And the kind
I think
of...
it, Yeah, I think it does too. And I've noticed that in books like that, often, not always, but often when the biographer's voice is very strong, it's often when the story does have a lot of gaps and where the biographer decides, you know, I'm going to make a virtue of necessity in a way by dealing with, in a sense, epistemology. How do you know things and what happens when you don't know certain things? And get the reader hooked on the very process of doing biography. I think that that happens when you don't have, in a sense, a wealth of information, and you have to figure out a way to tell the story. Mm-hmm.
What this really points out to me, I think, is the degree to which the biographer is creating a story. It's not, the biographer isn't simply discovering a story that's already there, but is deciding how to put things together to tell an interesting story, which is based on facts, on evidence, but which is really a creative act. It's a construction as much as a novel.
Well put.
I agree. Yeah, I think that's true. No, I think it's the way it's told. It's not fiction, but the way I would compose a biography of a certain figure is clearly not the way somebody else might do it, given their own background and their own reading of the evidence, which again is why there are so often, you know, more than one biography of the same subject. If it's a fascinating subject with lots of angles, you're going to get different versions of that life. And often yes, it's true with writers who write memoirs. You know, Frederick Douglass wrote more than one. You know, which version is the one that we can't say one is right. One could be written better than another. But I think that there's a case where Douglass himself knew that, you know, his life was changing as he was writing it. Mm-hmm.
Well, if we have nothing more to say about this issue, perhaps we can move on to what we might describe as more mechanical issues. Not that I'm sure we won't stay mired in mechanics for long, but it's perhaps a helpful guide. The first issue I'd like to have your opinions on is using prologues. What is the purpose of a prologue? Do you think they're necessary? What do you try to do in a prologue? Carol, can we start with you?
Sure. Well, what you try to do in a prologue is get a reader's attention or a reviewer's attention or a book review editor's attention, and just anyone would be opening the book that you hope will continue. So it's a place for a hook. I think traditionally, you know, probably a long time ago, maybe in the 19th century even, prologues were something else. They were more of an introduction and a summary and that kind of thing. But nowadays they tend to be a bit more dramatic for that hooking purpose. Another reason I would use one is goes along with that, which is that I have not written a biography that is not basically chronological. It seems beyond me to do that. And if you're going to be chronological, you're going to be starting with someone's family history and childhood, and you can mix it up a little bit. But yeah, that's usually, it's an essential and fascinating part of a life, but usually not the part that's most exciting to read about. So it's a good idea to start with something else. You certainly don't want to start with so-and-so was born unless there's something really unusual about the circumstances of the birth.
I'm sorry, Carol, I didn't mean to cut you off there. Go ahead.
Oh, I was having another thought that I have read some contemporary biographies that kind of start with an argument for the importance of their subject. And I think that's another useful way to go rather than a dramatic scene, especially if the subject is not well known. And I'm done now.
Since I can't see you, it's hard to know when people have finished. Carl, how about you? What do you think of prologues?
Well, I think Carol says it well. I won't repeat what Carol says. I certainly agree with what she says. There are different purposes for the prologue, for example, depending on how well the subject is known and whether there have been other biographies of the subject. I can think in a couple of my biographies, my first biography of Marilyn Monroe, even then there had been quite a few books about her. And I felt it was important. I don't think I used the word prologue, just an introduction, but it's the same thing in a sense. I started by, because Marilyn Monroe was so well known, especially when I was writing this book in the 80s, I thought it was important to talk a bit about the other books, what I learned from them, but also what made my book different, and sort of staking out a claim to the uniqueness of my book, which was, the subtitle was A Life of the Actress, and I took that subtitle very seriously. I felt that no previous book had really looked at her from the point of view of an actor. And I thought of myself that way with my own training in acting. So that became a very important part of my presentation of her, that we're really dealing with the life, the biography of an actress. And then more recently, with my William Faulkner biography, there have been several quite large biographies of him, as well as some short ones. And it's perfectly natural for a reader to ask, why another one? Why do you need another biography of William Faulkner? And so I had a couple epigraphs, by the way, at the beginning, one of which talked about Faulkner's originality, how no one had ever really written like him, and that you couldn't understand him by looking at his predecessors. And the other was a comment from one of his letters about how he liked to think of himself as an artist, but he was really angry about all these family responsibilities he had. And I thought that those were two key things that I wanted the reader to know before I ever said anything. So I used the epigraphs that way. Mm-hmm. And then I started by talking about him as a writer who has had many biographies, and just talked a bit particularly about the most important ones, like Joseph Blattner's biography, and what the strengths and also what some of the limitations were that I felt that I could remedy in some ways. I wasn't really trying to disparage him at all, but rather to point out that biography is a process. It's a historical process itself. And as a result, especially with major figures like Faulkner, you're not only going to get different interpretations, but he's going to look differently the further away you get from his own time in history, so to speak. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to turn next to discussing prefaces. I mean, I think in some cases these terms are used interchangeably, but Carl, I noticed that, for example, in your Faulkner, William Faulkner, most recent book, that you have essentially provided a narrative of the extensive research conducted in the preface. And that, I thought that was very interesting that you would put it up front so that people would have a sense of what work had gone into researching this piece.
Yeah, I thought that was important because I was trying to highlight that there were certain archives that either had not been used very much or not used at all, which was, again, sort of another argument for why another biography of William Faulkner.
And Carol, I noticed that
you've used an acknowledgement section in in Ellis Adams. And that the acknowledgments really provide an opportunity to create a record of the research journey that you undertook in writing that book.
That's interesting you put it that way, because I had a little note here next to your question that the acknowledgments are a resume research. So I guess I have used it that way. I think on my first one, I wrote an even longer one, and I was bragging about how much research I'd done, really. But I wanted people to know, of course.
Yeah, seems fair enough.
And with the Carver, it had a lot of names of people interviewed and other people thanked. And I think I tried to trim it down on Adams, but that, I mean, there's some people you have to acknowledge, like you want to acknowledge archives and sometimes librarians and, you know, particular people that have helped you a great deal. But it's also, I think, a chance to kind of make that sketch of what went into the book. I always enjoy putting that part together.
You know what I want to do now? In my next biography, I want, instead of an acknowledgement section, I want to have a title, Bragging.
Yeah. Well, I've heard people. Go ahead, Carl.
Yeah, one other thing about acknowledgements. I don't know how Carol's going to feel about this, but, you know, acknowledgements in biographers' books are almost never honest. what I mean by that is, it's not that you're telling whoppers, that you're telling a bunch of lies, but if you look at the acknowledgements, everyone was wonderful to you. You know, you never talk about the pain in the ass archivist, you know, who looked at you like they were doing you a big goddamn favor. You don't have, you know, and or a family member. I reviewed a book by a biographer. I'll mention the biographer's name. And he offers these profuse thanks and his acknowledgments. And he wrote thanking me for the review. It was a very positive review. And I must have said something about family members because, you know, he just said in passing, boy, she was a pain in the ass. Well, you know, you don't put that in the acknowledgments. It would be bad form, I suppose. People would think, you know, you leave yourself open to all kinds of attacks if you ever did do that. And second of all, who knows when you might not need them again?
Mm-hmm.
So the acknowledgments are a tricky thing. Sometimes you have to read between the lines to understand what's going on in those acknowledgments.
So you don't want to burn your sources. You may need them again.
Yeah.
Some people say that they turn to the acknowledgments first when they're picking up a biography.
Yeah, I do that when I review a biography, especially. I'm very keen to see, you know, what archives the person went to, the biographer went to, who they interviewed. And if I know something about the topic, it becomes very interesting to me to see who they didn't interview.
Or right. Couldn't.
Sorry, Carol, do you have something to add?
I just agreed with that. It's too bad we're not on Zoom. We could tell when we're
still. Yeah. It's a limit of our technology, but it still is working quite well. I think and I would just say to you, both of you, that if I'm cutting you off, please just let me know. I'd be happy to stop doing that.
Just one more thing I wanted to say about the acknowledgments. Sorry, it's, you know, like Billy Crystal, don't get me started.
No, just go ahead.
With my Lillian Hellman biography, I wanted to include a list of the people who said no. I don't want to talk to you. And my editor talked me out of it. She said, that's going to look really bad. You know, like sour grapes. You shouldn't do that. I thought there was actually kind of a value in that, of being upfront about the people who just wouldn't talk to me. But it's not there.
Yeah, I think what you said initially is quite true. That is that the acknowledgments are not always truthful. They don't really set out what happened.
I'd say they're not the full story.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it occurs to me, thinking about my Carver book and the way Tess Gallagher, the widow, did not help me. I kind of wish now I'd said more about that in the acknowledgments. I'm not sure I said anything at all, but that would have been a very polite way to at least state that.
Yeah.
You know, state it as a regret, or which would be accurate. I did regret it.
Yes.
It's a place where you do use your voice, even in a book that doesn't have the author's voice anywhere else.
I think we're going to turn next to talk about endnotes, footnotes, blind notes, and whether they should be used, and if there are any if there's any advice you have on them. I notice, Carl, that there are no notes in your biography of Martha Gellhorn, and I was wondering why that was.
Did you look at the ebook? Because I do have notes.
It's in the ebook. Oh, I looked at the ebook. Yeah.
Yeah. That's I did. Oh, you know, that's a reprint. That's interesting that you say that. It was done by Open Road Media, and they were going to charge me to include the notes.
Really?
And so the notes weren't included. It was part of an Authors Guild deal where the book was produced completely free, and you had the choice of paying for the notes or not having the notes there. So in fact, if you go to the hardcover or the paperback of the Gellhorn biography, there are plenty of notes. Yeah, I've never done a biography without notes.
I thought it was a bit odd, so I just that's why I asked you about it.
I'm glad you asked. Yeah.
That's interesting. So typically then you do use notes.
Yes.
I know that Carol does. And what about the use of end notes or footnotes? Or blind notes. I know, Carol, you have a very interesting idea about using both end notes and footnotes, and the footnotes are used to really to identify sort of dramatic things that are happening on the page, or perhaps for the biographer to make a meta comment about what is taking place. Would you like to talk a bit about that?
That's exactly how I like to use footnotes, and they should be rare, but I think they can, to me, they're kind of fun. You have to be careful, but they can be a place to introduce a different tone or, as you said, a meta comment or a detail that doesn't fit but is too good to leave out. I don't know. I probably have, you probably know how many I used in one of my books. I'm not sure. They're not on every page. It's important that they not be on every page.
Right.
Endnotes, I think, are the preferred method for any trade book. You can use footnotes in some university publications. And then you get to blind notes versus numbered endnotes. And that is a big technical mess, but you can do blind notes, which simply means that instead of a number for the note, there is a page number associated with the note. And there is no number, no note number floating in the text. Mm-hmm. If the reader wants to know something about the material on a certain page, they look in the back for that page number. I have never been able to do that because of a couple of glitches that occurred in my publication process. Hmm. But I think it is the best thing to do. It's just leaves you with a cleaner reading page in the text.
Yes. Carl, what's your opinion on this?
You know, it depends on the book again. I've done it every which way. The Faulkner book was done with the University of Virginia Press, and they were very happy with that. I suggested various ways of doing the notes, and they wanted the traditional notes, footnotes. Not mm-hmm. The notes aren't at the bottom of the page. They are, in a sense, end notes, but they're mm-hmm. numbered. And I even suggested ways in which I could combine, sort of portmanteau notes. And they didn't want that. They wanted a very precise documentation in the book. And so I was happy with that because that's the way I wrote it. So it would have been more work to change it around. Now, I've also done blind notes for particularly trade biographies. And even for a university press, I did something else. For instance, with my Last Days of Sylvia Plath, I list all my sources at the end in a kind of narrative, commenting, giving you what my sources of information are and commenting a little bit about that source, trying to make it almost a kind of narrative in itself. I like what Carol says about the notes. I'm trying to think of, Richard Holmes, the author of Footsteps and other books and about biography and a biographer himself, who looked upon footnotes as a kind of being in dialogue with your own book. I think that's an interesting idea. I think he does that in the Shelley biography, for example. I do something like that. Sometimes you have this sense that readers might want to know about something and more that you say in the narrative, and yet you feel it might throw the narrative out of whack if you give them everything you know. So you put that into the notes. That's a good handy place for that. I did that a lot with the Hellman biography. I got some very talky notes and notes in that biography.
Interesting. Shifting slightly, what about bibliographies? Are you inclined to use those?
I am. I think all my biographies, maybe A Private Life of Michael Foote doesn't have that kind of thing, but that's more almost like a memoir biography. But I think in most of the biographies, I have a bibliography because it's tied to the way I do the notes. That is, when you see the note to a text, or a book in my bibliography, or an article, I'll use that author's name in the note, but I won't give you the full reference because it's in the bibliography, if you see what I mean. So I might just be, say, Blotner 34, if I'm using page numbers, for example, unless he's written other things, which he has. He did a one volume condensation of his biography. So I have abbreviations for that, Blotner 2, Blotner 3, that kind of thing, so that readers know what I'm talking about. And I have the list of abbreviations right there with the bibliography.
Right. And Carol, what's your practice?
I did not have a bibliography in either one of these books. And I think it was because there wasn't really a lot of critical material on either author. Mm-hmm. So I didn't feel it was needed. But of course, all the information is in the notes. It's a little harder for the reader to find that way, but it's there. I do have, for both of them, material in the back of the book about the publications of my subject. With Carver, that was something I really wanted to provide. I felt the world needed it. It was such a mess where his first publications had occurred, and there was no formal published bibliography of him for that kind of material. So I did add all that. And with Alice Adams, I just wanted readers to have a list of her books because she wrote a lot of books. So that's a different kind of material at the back of the book, but I haven't done a bibliography. I'm doing one now for Oxford on Alice Adams. It's a lot of work.
Ah, interesting. One of the things, Carol, that I really liked about Alice Adams was the way in which you had a collection of photos toward the end, and fairly interesting descriptions of what's taking place in the photo, or describing what the characters are doing. And I thought it's really a very interesting part of the book.
Thank you. Yeah, I think we talked about photos in an earlier session, but I like the idea of photos with captions that tell a story.
Yes, I think when we talked about it before, we sort of focused on the photos in Alice Adams that come at the at each section beginning. And I just, I wanted to mention that I really do think these are great photos, and the captions are really informative. Let's just change for a moment to a question about the practice of writing. How many words do you write a day? What do you have a goal? Do you have a schedule? Do you try to achieve something within a week or a month? Or how does that work for you? Carl, I know you've said that you try to do 1,000 words a day. Is that what you really try to do? That seems like a lot to me.
Yeah, sometimes it's 500, sometimes it's under 1,000, but yeah, often it's 3 or 4 pages, which amounts to about 1,000 words.
Yeah,
those often are not certainly those words are not the final form of the book.
Yeah,
but I love that kind of momentum when I'm ready to write. I'm I tend to write every day. And usually it's a 2 to 3 hour period. I rarely go beyond that. And I rarely write at any other time of the day except the morning, when I'm still full of illusions and the world hasn't gotten to me.
Right. What time do you start?
I used to start really early, like 6 in the morning, 5, 6 in the morning. But now I'm in retirement. And usually I do breakfast and walk the dogs, and I might get to it by 9 o'clock if I'm in good shape. And then I'll go to maybe just before lunch. I make lunch, so I've got to factor that in too.
Right. What about you, Carol? When do you start, and how many words do you try and do a day?
When I'm working on a book, I always work in the morning, if mm-hmm. it's at all possible. Not as early as Carl. I've never really been a morning person, but somehow in middle age, I discovered that you had to be a morning person if you were going to finish anything. Alice Adams gave me a pass, though, on that business of having to start first thing in the morning, because I used to have in my head that if I were going to write in the morning, I'd have to do it before I even talked to anyone or dealt with anything else. Mm-hmm. And then if something did interrupt me, you know, heaven forbid, one of the other people in the household or the dog or you know, business came along, I would be so angry that I hadn't been able to do my writing first. And when I let go of that, which was advice from Alice Adams herself, and she said, you know, she would do stuff around the house for a while and start writing about 9 or 10. Huh. And that seemed to work so well for her. And I started doing that, and it is much better. You're still fresh, but you're less likely to get interrupted, or because you've taken care of those interruptions first. Number of words, that with me varies. Some days I'd probably write more than 1,000 words if I'm going on something and mm-hmm. got all the research done. But there are other days where I have to sort out some tangle. I mean, I have the research done probably, but As I write, questions always come up. Mm-hmm. Sometimes just a sentence will raise a question, because you can't quite write a good sentence without one more piece of information. I don't know. Does that happen to you, Carl? I'm just curious.
Yeah, it does. I tend to keep going and sort of mark that sentence or passage that I know I'm going to have to go over again. Mm-hmm. But I tend to sort of work through those things. It doesn't stop me from writing. I just keep going. I'm doing something very different now. I think a lot of what happened to me was the way I started as a biographer. You know, I had a deadline, particularly in my second biography of Hillman. I had a 12-month deadline after having worked on a proposal for 3 months. That's what I worked into doing every day. What I'm doing now is writing a book. I have a contract for it, but I don't like the contract, and I'm going to get rid of that contract. And I'm writing a book that's turned into something different. That's why I want to get rid of that contract. And I'm not going to try to write a proposal and get another publisher. I'm doing something very different. It's written in tandem with my book, Sylvia Plath, Day by Day, which is a kind of documentary biography. And I'm discovering new things. That's how I found out about this new piece of research about Plath and her therapist, which I'm going to investigate. I'm writing about a paragraph a day, maybe 200 words. And that's all I write. Each day I'm going through about 2 weeks of her life. So there's some days when I'm not writing that paragraph because I'm not writing about every 2 weeks of her life. So I'm doing that for the other book. So that's really slowed me down. But I don't mind, because I'm not meeting somebody's deadline. I'm just going on faith that someone will eventually buy this book.
Hemingway said that he read each morning everything he had written before, so that it was there was sort of an ongoing before he got to a few days.
His work. Does that sound familiar to either of
you, Carol?
That would be fatal for me. I'd be rewriting and never getting to the new stuff. It's good to where you left off. The other thing Hemingway said, I think, you'll know if it's true, Tim, was that you should leave off in a place that would ensure that you had a place to pick up the next day. That seems like a good idea. I also, you asked about timelines. I would always set myself deadlines for finishing chapters. I tended to think in chapters, probably because I'm a short story writer, and I liked my chapters to have the shape of short stories. So I would, I'd try to know what, on a certain day or week I would finish a chapter.
Carl, anything to add before we press on to what I'm going to describe as?
Sure. Just to reinforce what Carol said, I do stop when I know where I'm going to pick up again. And I don't read everything that I've written before, but each day I read what I wrote the previous day, which means I'm only reading about 1,000 words, something like that. And then I just go on. But then I do stop. I could go on for, say, another 30 minutes or an hour, and I decide not to because I know I'm going to be pent up. I'm going to be full of what I'm going to write the next day, and I'm going to be thinking about it in the course of the day, and that gives me the momentum I need.
Actually, that Hemingway issue that I might just throw in here before we get on to the business of biography writing. Hemingway, after writing every morning, drank in order to sort of clear his mind so he could get rid of the work so it wouldn't plague him for the rest of the day. I'm not going to ask you whether you drink.
You can.
You drink like Hemingway. I don't drink like Hemingway. But do you do something to get rid of it, or do you let it percolate, or is it always with you? Is the work always there, or is there some way you can, do something different, like watch a movie or print book, or is it plaguing you? Does it preoccupy you? Carl, let me start with you.
Well, as I said, I write in the morning, I fix lunch, I eat lunch. And then usually for some reason, I'm just terribly tired and I take a nap.
Yeah.
And then once the nap is done, I might very well, if I have to mow the lawn, I'll mow the lawn, or I'll ride my bicycle, or I'll garden. And even during those activities, I'm often, I'm not dreaming about what I'm writing. That rarely happens. But in other activities, my wife says, "Where are you?" And I'm usually in my book.
Right.
And that doesn't bother me. I mean, it's an obsession, but it's one I like that I can live with.
What about you, Carol?
When I'm writing a book, I do even dream about it sometimes. I mean, once in a while I get an idea, not so much dreaming, but that lucid dreaming time when you're waking up and you're thinking about dreaming consciously or something. A little bit of that, but mainly, for me, it's getting outdoors, or housework doesn't work as well. I don't enjoy it as much as I should, but outdoors always helps. Hiking, going to the beach, something like that. But the book is always with me. Right. There's so much to do to finish one of these.
Thank you for those comments. I'd like now to just turn to the question, or several questions relating to the business of biography. The first issue is, what's the difference between publishing with a university press or a trade press? What are the considerations in deciding whether you should pitch a book to a university press or to a trade press? Carol, do you want to start?
I'll start, but both my books have, well, I did publish a book with the University Press before I became a biographer. It was a book of literary criticism. And it's a wonderful process with a good university press. The drawbacks are that they don't pay you very much and that they have a different kind of process for acceptance. They send books to outside readers, so that can be a long process, and not depending on the readers they choose, it may not serve you well. What's the third thing I was going to say about that? Oh, the benefit is that you don't need an agent to make a submission to a university press. Trade presses will get you to your next question, which is, do you need an agent? And in many cases, you do. But there's a category you left out, which is the smaller independent press that is not a university. That's a good zone, can work with an agent or without. It has a lot to do with the kind of subject, but why don't I hand it over to Carl for that, because he's done both.
Yes, there are real advantages now with university presses. For one thing, they tend to keep the book in print. Mm-hmm. And trade houses, unless it's been a very, very successful book, they might put it, sometimes they don't even do a paperback edition. They just do the hardcover and ebook. And then they let it go out of print. University presses generally don't do that. They keep the book in print. So that's an advantage, I think. It depends on, sometimes you have no choice. That is, it was true with Faulkner, although there have been trade biographies of Faulkner. By the time I got around to doing Faulkner, no trade publisher was interested, and I really needed to go to a university press. And the advance was certainly much lower than a trade book press. But I have to tell you, with several of my university press books, not only have they earned out their advances, they've made as much money as the trade books did. And so, but of course, that's over time. The thing about an advance from a trade publisher is you get it now, which for some writers, that's the most important thing. They're not going to be able to travel or do some other things if they don't get that advance from the publisher. So there are a lot of advantages to both. It really depends on your subject and whether you have an agent or not, and what the agent's sense of the market is for your book. Mm-hmm. It's really individual, one by, you know, one case.
You've mentioned, raised the question of agents. Do you think it's necessary to have an agent these days?
Well, I would say it's necessary, certainly, if you're going to deal with trade publishers, with big publishers. It's hard to get anybody's attention without an agent. Mm-hmm. An agent says, in a sense, that you're important or that someone has already looked at your stuff. And so they're recommending it to you. Whereas if you're just an author, it's very difficult now to get a trade publication's interest in your work. I don't know that there are any trade houses that look at books now unless they're agented, unless you have an agent.
Hmm. Once you have the manuscript completed, do you have people read it, or do you?
How do you go about things after,
or as you're working on the manuscript? Carol, why don't you start?
I have friends who are good readers, mm-hmm. and I certainly do rely on them sometimes. I like to have a book pretty far along before I do that. I think it's a great thing to do. I know there are, in fact, my own editor at Scribner thinks it's a bad idea, but I think it's a wonderful idea, and I trust my friends. I wouldn't have anyone read it whose opinion I didn't want, so.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. What about you, Carl? What do you do?
I don't share the book much with other people, even when it's completed. There are exceptions. For instance, with Sylvia Plath, there's a Plath scholar. I wouldn't think of publishing a book without him looking at it, because he's going to find some errors, some mistakes I've made, and he's going to save me some embarrassment. And that was true with Faulkner, but that was a university press. So as Carol says, not only do they send it out to readers when they're considering purchasing the book or doing the book, but they usually send it out to readers after you've done the book, completed, and you don't get the next part of the advance until after the publisher hears from readers. And they often have a form like, this book is publishable if the author does such and such a thing, the book is acceptable as is, or the book really isn't acceptable. So that there's that to contend with as well. So it depends a lot on the nature of the subject. If it's the first biography of somebody, other than I might show parts of biography of an actor to people who worked with the actor. I did this with Walter Brennan, with Kathy Nolan, who was with him in the Real McCoys. I do that kind of thing in bits and pieces.
Mm-hmm. Now, we came up the other day with the question of costs of writing a biography. How do you prepare to assume the costs? I suppose if you have an advance, that's a big advantage. But if you don't have an advance, what do you do? Are there steps that you take to try and cover these costs, grant applications, and so on? Carol, could you start with that?
There are. I think it's a good idea to have another source of income, whether it's, for many people, it's teaching or something else, other kinds of writing. I've been working with a biographer in Australia who has a business writing people's life stories, you know, kind of older people who want their story written down. That's one I hadn't heard before, but there's that. Yes, there are grants. The University of Texas has been generous to me with awards that allowed me to use the Alice Adams archive. I think I ended up spending a couple months there. And they give you, you know, it's just enough to pay your expenses. It's not a moneymaker, but it definitely takes the edge off. You know, and you try to combine your travel with your work. If you are traveling for pleasure, I think I remember what that was like. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's like anything else. You're not going to make easy money. It's expensive, and if you try to cut corners, that's exactly what will happen. You'll have to be rushing through an archive or trying to understand what a place is like in 2 days, whereas Robert Caro probably would have spent 2 months. But you know, you get good at it. I spent altogether probably 2 weeks in Yakima, Washington, mm-hmm. on the Carver book, and I feel like I really know that place. You know, maybe I'm kidding myself, but I really jumped into it while I was there.
Interesting. What about you, Carl? Any magic?
Well, yeah, not magic. And you know what? This is going to be, I think, our last question, because we're running out of time in our 60-minute podcast. Believe it or not, I know you have more questions, which means we're going to, I think, I have to do another one if we're agreeable. So to answer your question anyway, before we do conclude, I've applied for lots of grants. I've been successful 3 times with National Endowment for the Humanities, for example, American Council of Learned Societies. I've had a grant, other kinds of grants, especially from where I work, City University of New York. I'm retired now, and that's a big loss because they funded a lot of my travel. And sometimes it was for a book. Sometimes it was to go to a academic conference that was close to an archive that I wanted to look at anyway. So there were lots of ways in which I could combine sort of the business of being a university professor and also doing my research as a biographer. And fortunately, the City University, because it had all kinds of pots of money, was pretty generous with that. And I don't see how I could have done the books, so many biographies, without that help, which is why now I have to be extremely careful because no one's paying except me. So that's a difficult thing.
That is a rather sad state of affairs.
Yes. Do you want to give us a preview of coming attractions?
Well, we're going to continue on with some discussion of the business side of biography writing, negotiating the contract, the possibility of movie rights,
and are there books about biography writing that you would recommend?
Well, now that sounds like plenty. That sounds like part five of Coming Attractions. It sounds like we ought to call that episode The Business of Biography.
That sounds like a good idea.
Okay, I guess we're going to have to stop there, and we will continue. Thanks, Tim, and thanks, Carol.
Thank you both.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.